Thank you, choir. I enjoy listening to and watching them sing. I am struck today by the notion that we are mere days away now from Elizabeth joining us here in Franklin, finally. Her contract in Atlanta is coming to an end. She's been popping in for visits, and the next time you see her, she will have moved here for good. We think that'll be sometime this holiday weekend. One of her favorite, very favorite things to do is to sing in the choir. And she loves choir rehearsals as much as she loves Sunday mornings. And so she'll be up there soon. And that's going to be fun. In my newness here, I'm not sure who should be up there with her, though. There's got to be one or two of you sitting in front of me that should be sitting behind me. And so maybe you'll take the crossroads of her. And I see some of you now looking at and pointing at others in the room who ought to be in our choir. You might take Elizabeth's crossroads as a time when you can not be the only new one and go to rehearsal and join the choir as well and be part of what they do. I want to make sure something I should have mentioned earlier that we highlight that, and that is that this afternoon at 4 o'clock, our own Cody Billups is going to be part of a recognition ceremony up in Richmond. I plan to be there with Cody, and he'll be awarded a scholarship from the Baptist General Association of Virginia. And we're proud of Cody and glad that that is coming up. And so I just wanted to make sure we didn't note that. Cody's time will be coming to an end with us as the month ends. And so we look forward to hearing and seeing from Cody at least one more time before that. But this afternoon will be a very special afternoon. Well, I said that choir was Elizabeth's absolute favorite thing. Truth is, nothing I'm going to get up here and say is going to be any more favorited by her than choir rehearsals and choir singing in the worship services. It is her favorite thing. I think we all play favorites in life. We all have something that we might call loyalty or we might call favorite, but either way, it works out to be about the same. While Elizabeth is not here to defend herself, I'll tell a story on her. One time we were dining in Atlanta. I don't think she would have picked on a waiter if we'd been out of town. But as you know, Atlanta is home to the little company called Coca-Cola, a Fortune 100 company. And we, in fact, own a home at this moment that's 10 minutes from the worldwide headquarters of Coca-Cola. So call it a favorite, call it loyalty, but that has been her brand over all these years. We were in a restaurant in Atlanta one time, and Elizabeth ordered a Diet Coke, and the waiter said, "Oh, we serve Pepsi products. Will Diet Pepsi do?" And Elizabeth looked at him, my sweet Elizabeth, looked at him and said, "When it comes time to pay, will Monopoly money do?" We all have favorites. We all play favorites. But in our faith, we try not to. But I bet you have a favorite Bible character. Now, Jesus is the obvious answer. You heard about the little boy who was in Sunday school one morning, and the teacher said that, children, I want you all to name what I'm going to describe. Let me describe this. It's a furry little animal with a bushy tail, a long bushy tail, and it harvests nuts for the winter. And a little boy raised his hand, and the Sunday school teacher called on him, and the little boy said, "You know, for all the world, I know the answer has got to be Jesus, but it sounds like a squirrel to me." Jesus might be your easy favorite, but maybe you like Moses. Maybe you like David. Maybe Lydia or Christ's mother Mary or Ruth is a favorite of yours. Deborah, as we're going to find out this coming fall when we study from the book of Judges, Deborah actually occupied a series of offices that no one else in biblical history ever did, as a mother, a judge, and a military leader among the people of Israel. We all have favorites. Peter and Paul are also obvious favorites. Now, imagine the opportunity to go and to walk where they walk and to explore where they lived. Elizabeth and I had such a chance a year ago this week as we went with a group of people from a trip that was sponsored in Baptist Life by Nurturing Faith Publishing, which is the major news arm associated with the CBF. And the Campbell Divinity School, Campbell University Divinity School out of North Carolina. They sponsor a trip each May, and last year the trip was the Journeys of Paul and John. Now, quick commercial. This fall, on two Wednesday nights, Elizabeth and I are going to show you our pictures and tell you about that journey. It was absolutely fascinating to go to places that we have books of the Bible named after, to go to places that Paul and John especially had lived in, and to follow in their footsteps. And so you'll hear about that more in just a few weeks as we resume our fall Wednesday night schedule. We'll let you have a heads up on that and know that it's coming. Now, terrorist activity just before that trip had rendered the itinerary a little dangerous. It included parts of Greece and Turkey. They refigured the itinerary, and the trip spent almost its entirety in Greece, except for one morning in Ephesus, Turkey. I wouldn't have changed a thing now that we took the trip. I wouldn't have made it any different. It was fascinating to go to these places. One night, tired from a long day's travel, we checked into a nice hotel in the middle of downtown Athens, Greece. We had a meeting that we had to go to immediately after putting our belongings in our room. Then we were free to go to dinner, and then the rest of the evening was ours. We made our way up to the rooftop terrace, and the sky that greeted us there at the very top of that downtown hotel was pink and orange. It was one of the prettiest sights I've ever seen. Down below us, you could see the Olympic venues that we had fairly recently seen on our televisions as the world gathered there to compete. But what was happening off to our left was also fascinating. One of the couples, young couples from the divinity school that we were traveling with, were getting engaged on that rooftop terrace in Athens, Greece. It was something you couldn't script, you couldn't make it up. And off to our right, the only thing that possibly could have upstaged them was that we looked in the distance and could see up on the top of the Acropolis, that high mountain, the Parthenon. And we knew that soon we would be going there. What a fascinating, fascinating place. Turns out that high on atop the Acropolis, and by the way, every Greek and Roman city had an Acropolis, each town picked a hilltop, usually the highest hill, that was most visible from anywhere in the city, and they placed their temples, their significant religious altars and shrines, up on top of that hilltop. And so it was the most important part of their city, even though usually it was a little bit off in the distance. And so we found there not only the Parthenon, but probably up on that hill at least a dozen shrines and temples that had been built in ancient Greece. Ornate, expensive marble structures, the finest in design and construction efforts that they could give. They are amazing to hold. Of course, today we see mostly ruins because time and weather and earthquakes and conquest and even a little bit of recycling has rendered these now as ruins. But there's enough to be able to see that once it had been an overwhelming sight. During Paul's time, albeit under Roman rule, Athens was really the nerve center of a dominant intellectual and religious scene. The Hellenistic practices still set the pace in Greece in Paul's time. There were larger cities, believe it or not, in Greece than Athens at that time, but none more prominent in the minds and hearts of true Greeks especially. Okay, let me acknowledge at this point that I can't build an entire sermon around, hey, I've been there. But I will say that going there deepened my perspective. It helped me to understand how these cities that I had only heard of as biblical destinations and the sites of important happenings, how they fit together geographically. Why Paul, in his missionary journeys, was going where he did and why he went in the order that he did as he moved across these cities in time. It gave me perspective as to what made those cities important and what the dynamic of their day would have been as Paul spoke truth, sometimes to power. We got up on top of the Acropolis, and we walked where Paul had walked up onto that mountaintop. We overlooked down to the foot of the Acropolis where the great theater of Dionysus was, where the brilliant Greek tragedies of the day had been born. We could see in the flatlands the remains of the Agora, the business place, the government and business center of the city where often Paul would go to speak and teach and argue. We also saw more temple ruins down in the flatlands just below that great mountain. It was a fascinating sight to see. I can't wait to show it to you if you're interested this fall. And right next to the Acropolis, literally across a parking lot today, but certainly not in Paul's time, there was Mars Hill. You heard that mentioned in the scripture that we had read for us just a few minutes ago. And Paul was called there to Mars Hill in front of the Areopagus. They were a town council, if you will. They were the people that if you were to speak or try to lead in the city of Athens, you were going to have to go in front of. Now, if you've been to Atlanta, picture a tiny stone mountain without the laser show and the carvings. That's the hill known as Mars Hill. And that's the place where Paul found himself. And the dramatic backdrop that he would have had as he spoke the words we heard from Nancy's reading a few minutes ago would have been dramatic. I've given up golfing these days for writing. But back in my day when I was a pretty unspectacular player, I could have hit a 5-iron from the top of Mars Hill and struck the great gates that would lead you up onto and among the ruins atop the Acropolis. That's how close these two hills are to each other. And so you can imagine as Paul stands in front of that council to deliver the words that we heard, the dramatic backdrop that would have been behind him as he spoke what he did to that audience. To localize his message, he searched for a way to connect. And then it came to him looking at what was there, what all of them were staring at there on that great hilltop. He said, "I perceive that in every way you are a very religious people. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.'" They all knew the exact one that he meant. Verse 21 might set the tone for what was actually going on in our scripture today. In true Hellenistic culture, the Athenians of the day loved to gather and listen to one another. They wanted to hear each other out, or as verse 21 says it, they spent their days gathering either to tell or to hear something new. Debates, ideological positions, persuasive oratory of any kind. They loved it. This was not just an intellectual pursuit in Athens. Public speaking in Athens, Greece at that time was a contact sport. And at least a couple of writers suggest that it was commonplace for newcomers to the local debate scene to be called indeed in front of the Areopagus. Not because they were in trouble at all, but simply because they needed to be heard out in a preliminary way, a type of certification, if you will. So Paul was not as much on trial in court in this scene today as he was trying out. Asked what he was there to say in the public forum, Paul begins to preach much as he had in other places when he might go to their synagogue and stand on the steps. So he makes note that among their many temples, he has even seen one inscription to an unknown God. And he says that what they have held forth as an unknown God, a catch-all or just-in-case God, he presents to them now as the creator of the universe. One God who ironically will not be confined to living in any structure. One God who does not need any kind of sacrifice or help either. But instead, a God who is giver of life and breath and everything meaningful. Paul had in Athens what Theodore Ferris calls a congregation made up of the toughest hearers of all. Not so much those who were there because they believed or even wanted to believe, but instead a group of people who were there to hear your position for the sheer intellectual exercise of it. Ferris says that the Hellenistic mentality was to be happy so long as one could play with ideas or thoughts, much in the same way that a cat would play with a mouse. Paul's hearers, in other words, weren't really caring whether he persuaded them or not. Truth is, they probably planned not to be persuaded, as Paul spoke in our Acts chapter 17 text. They weren't there as seekers after a new faith, or as Ferris puts it, what Paul had waiting for him there on Mars Hill was the silent scorn of the intellectual snob, the cool indifference of the sermon taster. They just wanted to hear something new, anything. And he didn't disappoint. I have a friend named Vince. This friend loves to say that he never lettered in any sport in high school, didn't grow up playing anything, but at the age of 64, he took up running. Out of a want to get in better shape and to lose some weight, Vince took up running at night. And 50 pounds later, and now at the age of 66, turns out Vince is a very good runner. I saw him last July 4th as he passed in front of the doors of the church that I was serving in Atlanta. Atlanta hosts each year the Peachtree Road Race, the world's largest 10K race, and our church served water every year to the runners that would come in front of our doors, 60,000 of them each 4th of July. Vince stopped by last year during that race simply to say hello to me. He didn't want any of our water. He was ready to go and make the best time that he could because he was using that race to qualify for the Chicago Marathon. Now, as amazing as that is, I tell you that to say this. There was a runner inside Vince all those years, all those decades of his life. There was a runner looking to be discovered. But it took the right timing and the right circumstances before he was led to see something in himself that he never could have before. And Paul lays out a similar notion in his words in front of that council in Athens. And in doing so here in our text, Paul wraps up and gives us one of the more enjoyable surprises that we're going to find in those words that we have heard this morning. All of us have a curiosity that yearns to be satisfied. It is wired into our very beings. Now, I know that person who says, I don't have a faith. I'm not a religious person. Maybe you have said that. Maybe you would say that right now. But as one scholar poses, let me ask you this. Have you ever come home late at night and looked up into the sky and suddenly caught your breath as you looked up at the stars and felt a ripple through your very soul because you marveled at the silent glory of the sky? Or have you ever planted a garden and let the dust from the seeds filter through your fingers and then placed them into the ground and then covered them up and watered them and stood there and wondered how they were going to burst forth from under the ground and produce vegetation? Have you ever pondered that? How that works? Have you ever sat listening to words or music and been drawn to the outer fringe of time and space as the waves of sound finally broke on the brink of the last horizon? Or, if none of those connect with you, have you ever stared over into a crib at a baby and pondered the mystery and the wonder of life, where it comes from and where it goes to? If yes is your answer to any of those questions, then you are a religious person because you have pondered mysteries and causes that are beyond you and greater than you. We all have secret altars to unknown gods before which we have worshiped unconsciously. Some of us may have made the same choice Paul did over time, choosing to view that mysterious one as the God of creation. If this sounds familiar, you're not alone. No less than Blaise Pascal, in his writings in the 1600s, this mathematician and physicist began to ponder things beyond him and things that could not be measured and could not be counted. And he came to the conclusion that has traveled with us through time. Blaise Pascal put a name to what Paul was talking about in Acts chapter 17 when he said there is a God-shaped hole, a God-sized hole in all of us that can only be filled by the one thing that fits it. Or, if you have read Ecclesiastes in the third chapter, starting with verse 10, you have heard these words. The writer in our Old Testament wisdom, Ecclesiastes, says, I have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful in His time. He has set also eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. And later in time, Augustine of Hippo, who was a rebellious person who lived in the 4th and 5th centuries, wrestled deeply with the notion of any belief of any kind and took a long time before he reached this conclusion. And he wrote this down in what is now famously known as his Confessions. He said, You have made us for Yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they find rest in You. So here's our beautiful surprise, I think. At Mars Hill, Paul asserts that the struggle is real because humans have been created to seek God out in the hopes, verse 27 says, that they might feel after God and find God. Yet He is not far from each of us, for in God we live and move and have our being. When I was in Atlanta, there was a time in which I was involved in a CBF-sponsored peer learning group. We did a variety of things. We had guests come in to teach us from their areas of expertise. Sometimes we read a book and talked about that. We got together about quarterly and met. One time, we decided that we would go through the traveling exhibition called Dialogue in the Dark. Dialogue in the Dark was moving from city to city, and it stayed in Atlanta for about a year. What they do at Dialogue in the Dark is simulate, for those of us who are seeing people, what the world would be like for the blind. They set up a number of rooms for you to go into, and each room has a common everyday challenge that is unbelievable in absolute perfect darkness. And so they walked us through the orientation of that. They assured us that we would have a guide who would go all the way through with us. They urged us to be as careful as we could. And then they handed us those long red and white sticks, and they turned out the lights. And our group stumbled and fumbled its way through this experience. They had a room that simulated what it would be like to try to cross the street if you couldn't see, or order in a restaurant, or select groceries in a market and pay your bill, or try to board and sit down in a small boat that was bobbing back and forth on the water, or find a safe place by yourself to sit down on a bench along a busy street. These everyday occurrences suddenly were very difficult, and we felt helpless. We found ourselves searching through the room, unbelieving how inept we were at these everyday tasks that we usually never thought about. We marveled at how we had tripped and groped and felt our way through each station, searching for the finish line and just trying not to get hurt. God, Paul says, has created us to search and to ponder the divine, at times to even wrestle with faith. Now, if you can't quite get satisfied with some of your questions, if you can't quite get comfortable with some of the doubts that pop up every now and then, let me encourage you by saying that you simply sound human to me. Paul acknowledges that he wrestled and fought against the whole notion of faith in God through Jesus Christ, and yet here he was now, the unlikeliest of spokespersons, standing in Athens, Greece, before the Areopagus, and telling them of a conclusion that he himself could not believe he had reached. The results of his sermonette were pretty real. If you read in Acts chapter 17, you'll hear something that's fairly understandable and not all that surprising at all. Predictably, many were not convinced. They even mocked him. Some said they didn't believe but wanted to hear more from Paul. The group that catches my attention are those who joined him and did believe. Something fit their life journey that day. Something connected with them that made sense. They made the choice to believe and continue exploring the faith, much as you and I may have at some point in our lives. And so the assignment of our lifetime now is to explore that faith. Well, Paul heads directly to the nearby and larger town of Corinth, which we also went to on that trip, and where he would spend more than a year living and working. He didn't stay in Athens very long. He was not received particularly well, and we notice that no church springs up in Athens as a result of his visit. But we do, through historical, extra-biblical sources, find out that Dionysus was mentioned as being the first bishop of Athens later on. So something caught, something simmered, something eventually surfaced that became a church in Athens. Eusebius backs this up in his tradition, in his writings. Something eventually happened. And Paul goes to Corinth, and there Luke records Stephen as the first convert in that area. Paul himself will later remind the Corinthians that he had arrived among them weakened and in much fear and trembling, some believe from his humbling experience among the intellectuals at Athens. He has cried the tears that every minister has cried over their cereal on Monday morning or in the silence of the night on Sunday night, wondering what it is we're getting done. So what do we do with all this? Why did this story make it into Luke's account of Acts? And how did this, which didn't seem to catch fire very soon, how did this episode advance the gospel cause in that place? Well, for starters, Paul clarified the message in a way that connected at least a little bit locally. We are reminded that persuasion is much more often the work of the Holy Spirit, and this should encourage us in our everyday living of our faith. Luke thought enough of what happened to write down both the action and the message. And in that message, if you don't take anything else away today, I want you to take the gift that others have come along later and called the God-shaped hole in each of us that longs to be filled and will not be filled by anything else that we can try to use. And Paul said something else. Something that we can say to others. He said to them, "I see your spiritual hunger. I have found this to be helpful. You might too." We can say that. We live in an age of spiritual seeking, not at all unlike the time in which Paul found Athens. To an age that has known such instability, we at Franklin Baptist Church today offer not only a tested faith, but also a fellowship that has remained on this corner since the 1870s. The witness was clarified at Athens. Paul did that. And we can too. Thanks be to God. We are going to sing a hymn of response just now. It's hymn number 39. "Rejoice, you pure in heart." If you've been journeying with us for a few weeks and come to like these people, if you feel accepted and wanted and welcome, you may choose to use this response time to come down front. I'll be waiting. We'd love to introduce you into the membership of our church. You may have a response to God, having heard something differently today. And you may want to offer that response as we sing. In any case, we stand just now and sing hymn number 39.